Parshat Kisetse, as we know, has many, many mitzvos. And one of the very intriguing mitzvos at the beginning of the Parsha is that of the Ben Sora Umora, the wayward and rebellious son. And there's, of course, a great deal to speak about with regards to this particular mitzvah. Indeed, the Gemara says about this mitzvah, Derosh Bekabel Sachar, expound upon it and receive reward. And there is indeed a chapter of Mishnayos, Maseches Sanhedrin, the 8th Perek is Perek Ben Sora Umora. I'd like to focus on one detail, a fascinating comment from one of the more recent Talmidei Chachamim. What is it that the Ben Sora Umora does? Well, the Pasuk states in Perek Kaf Aleph, Pasuk Kaf, the Amru El Zikne Iro, the parents say to the elders, Beneinu Zeh Sorer Umorer, this child is a Ben Sora Umora, Einenu Shomer B'Koleinu, he doesn't listen to us. They actually have that in common with many parents, but here it says Zolel V'Sovei. Zolel V'Sovei refers to eating and drinking excessively. Zolel is to gorge, Sovei is to drink to excess. And the question is, how much is too much? That question needs to be answered because it's a halachic discussion. And indeed, the Mishnah in Maseches Sanhedrin says that the Ben Sora Umora, there's a certain amount. It's not a kezias, it's not a revius. Rather, it's what's called a tartimar of meat. However, the Gemara will define a tartimar. And chetzi lug yain ha'italki, and a half lug of Italian wine. So what's interesting here is that when it comes to the wine, the Mishnah specifies what type of wine, or the origins of the wine. Yain ha'italki, the implication seems to be that if it's wine from somewhere else, it wouldn't have that result. But the question is that so, and why would it be so? What's the yichus of yain ha'italki, this Italian wine? Well, Rashi comments that the wine from Italy is meshubach bimyuchad. It is exceptionally good, which is normally a good thing, but here is a bad thing, because that means that he will develop a taste for it, and that he will become dependent upon it, and that, of course, will lead to no good. And therefore, the reason why Yein Ha'italki has a distinct mention is because of its special high quality. That's how Rashi explains. Apparently, if it's a shvacha wine, he'll grow out of it. But if it's Yein Ha'italki, he'll grow into it. But there is another very interesting explanation offered for the specific reference of Yein Ha'italki. We know that the Pasuk states, Zolel v'Sovei, he's eating and he's drinking. And moreover, the Gemara tells us that he steals money from his parents in order to finance these habits. And that's part of the problem, really. And yet, the Gemara says an amazing thing. If the eating and drinking of this meat and wine takes place within the context of a seudas mitzvah, then he would not become a Ben Sora Umora based on that feast. That means the amount may be there, and the foods may be there, it's the Italian wine, and it's the special meat, but it happened in a seudas mitzvah, he was at a bar mitzvah, or a wedding, then he does not become a Ben Sora Umora. And the question is, why? Why does he get a pass? Normally, to bring a criminal activity into a mitzvah doesn't make it better. It could possibly make it worse. What's behind the anomaly here that he doesn't become a Ben Sora Umora from a Seudas Mitzvah? Well, one of the classic Sforim on Maseches Sanhedrin is the Sefer Margolios Hayam. Margolios Hayam was written by Reb Reuven Margolios, and he himself was a towering Talmud Chacham. I was told he was a librarian by trade. He worked in the Ben Maimon library in Tel Aviv, and it was known that anyone, and this is before databases and word searches, which sometimes help, that anyone who was researching any topic in Torah could go to him at the desk, tell him what they wished to look into. He would come back a few moments later with every single volume in that library that had any bearing on that topic. And his reach was simply overwhelming. And Reb Ruvi Margolius, in the Margolius Hayam, reminds us that the problem with the Ben Sora Umorer lies not so much in what he has done. I mean, he hasn't yet committed a capital crime. It's wrong to steal from his parents. It's wrong to get involved in these sorts of activities, but none of them are capital offenses. The problem is not so much what he's done, but what he's headed towards. For as the Gemara tells us, and Rashi quotes in synopsized form on our pasuk, is that since he develops these habits, habits need to be sustained. They need to be financed. Sooner or later, his parents will run out of money. But he's not going to stop at that point. Rather, he will look elsewhere. And unfortunately, this really is a description that is apt for many such habits, even in our times. And he will stop short of nothing. That's the worry. Because if he needs the money bad enough, and the money's not forthcoming, or the person resists, he may even resort to bloodshed. And the Torah says it has to end now. Apparently that means that there's no hope. There isn't the expectation that he will spontaneously turn around. He seems to be on an irrevocable course. Now, we know practically that Ben Sora Umorer almost never happened, or according to the Gemara, never happened, or certainly according to one opinion. But certainly the idea is there. And therefore, if all of this happens at a Sudas Mitzvah, that's why it makes a difference. Because it doesn't mean that it's not an Aveira. But because it happens within the context of a Sudas Mitzvah, there is yet hope that this act will not lead him on an irreversible path. At the end of the day, he is partaking in a Sudas Mitzvah. You never know when that will make a difference, when that will mitigate, when that will break his stride a little bit in this downward path. And therefore, if there's a mitzvah element in terms of what he's doing, there's hope that it's not irrevocable. That's really what the Gemara is saying. And this leads us back to our Yain HaItalki, and Reb Ruvi Margolius has a fascinating explanation. We say in the bracha after Mezonos, the bracha of Ala Michya and Ala Geffen, we say, Va'aleinu lesocha, uvenei Yerushalayim, va'aleinu lesocha, v'samcheinu b'vinyana, v'nochal mipirya, v'nispa mituva, that we should eat from the fruits of, well, Eretz Yisrael, v'nispa mituva, be sated from its goodness, u'nevarech alev d'shal v'tara. And that, of course, that's the Nusach. Everyone knows. What's not so well known is that there was some objection to having this clause in the text of the Ala Michya. There are certain Rishonim who objected for a very simple reason. It seems to be less than the noble nature of the aspirations that we're voicing in the bracha. We're looking for wonderful goals, elevated goals, Binyan Yerushalayim, and in the middle somehow we shtup in there that we should eat the fruits and we should be satisfied from it. That's your goal. That's an aspiration. So much so that there were Rishonim who maintained that those words should not be said. It should go from Binyan Yerushalayim, Yir HaKodesh, Valeinu L'socha, and stop there or move on to the next bit. Not to mention V'nochal Mipriya. Actually, Yosef Karo in the Beis Yosef justifies or explains the inclusion of this cause. It's not so much for the eating of the fruits, which is not a very noble thing, but it's really leading up to the clause that comes next, which is Unavarecha Aleha Bikdusha Vatara. You can't make a bracha if you didn't eat, and therefore, as a lead in to Unavarecha Aleha, we mention Venochal Mipriya. And therefore, the inclusion of eating the fruits is okay, it's validated. But the Pais Chodosh, the Perush on the Torah, the Pais Chodosh, the Bach, has a different explanation. He says that eating the fruits, v'nochal mipriya, is a noble aspiration for a very simple and important reason. And that is the fruits of Eretz Yisrael, Uvenei Yerushalayim, Ba'aleinu Secha, the fruits of Eretz Yisrael have Kedusha. Why does fruit of Eretz Yisrael have Kedusha? Because Eretz Yisrael has Kedusha, and that's where the fruit comes from. And therefore, when a person eats of those fruits, he himself absorbs Kedusha. He ingests Kedusha. Ingesting Kedusha is a noble aspiration. And therefore, says the Bayis Chadosh, we do say v'nochal mipriya, because we wish to grow in Kedusha. And one of the ways to grow in Kedusha is to eat the fruits of Eretz Yisrael, which are grown in Kedusha. And there's other ways also, but it takes its place along all of the other goals stated there. Dvarim nifloim. So says the Bach. And therefore, Rebbe Reuven Margolius suggests that perhaps the reason why, back to the Mishnah, which says that he becomes a ben sora umorer if he drinks Yena Italki, and it's specified Italian wine. What's the yichus of Italian wine? It has no yichus. That's the problem. What it means to say it is to mark the problematic wine as wine that is the produce of Chutz La'aretz. And Italy is taken as a generic example. As if to say, and it's a very fascinating possibility, lahalacha, if the wine was grown in Eretz Yisrael, then perhaps if that's the wine that he drinks, maybe he doesn't become a ben sora umorer. Similar to the din, that if he drank the wine as part of a sudas mitzvah, so the sudas mitzvah can help him. Maybe the kedusha of Eretz Yisrael can help him as well. He needs a few other things to help him, but perhaps it is not the same as Yein HaItalki and all that represents. So that's a really wonderful comment from the Sefer Margolius Hayam, and it's a good reminder for most cases in life which are not Ben Sora Umera situations, but nonetheless, to choose between Totera Ta'aretz and Chutz La'aretz, V'nochal Mipirya V'nisba Metuva, is a different enterprise altogether, according to the Bayis Chodesh. I'd like to move from there to devote some time to a halacha that is found in the end of the parsha, in the beginning of Perek Kafhei, and that's the halacha of malchus, of lashes, which is the standard, for want of a better expression, punishment for transgressing a lo sase. And as we'll see, there's one or two psukim and a great deal to discuss in terms of parshanut. So let us move to the beginning of Perek Kafhei, and the first pasuk describes a din Torah, and sometimes it can lead to malchus. It can malchus. Pasuk base of Perek Kafhei states, "V'hayah im bin hakos harasha." Let's say someone has been incriminated in Bezdin, and he's liable for makos, malchus. V'hipilo hashofet v'hiko lefanav. So the shofet stoops him over and administers malchus, kedei rishaso, in keeping with his wickedness, b'mispar, in number. How many? Pasuk, arba'im yakenu, 40, he shall strike him, lo yosif, no more, pen yosif la'akoso al eile makaraba, because if he may come to hit him excessively, and that's actually a negative prohibition. To administer an additional lash is actually an aveira on the part of the Bezdin. And this actually is the source for violent action ever against Yisrael. If it's also for the Bezdin to administer an extra lash, every violent act is extra, is superfluous as far as the halacha is concerned. It's actually a los, I say, to strike someone, assuming that you're not saving someone else in the process. And so, once again, the pasuk has told us, arba'im yakenu lo yosef, 40, but no more than 40. Now, as we know, the number of malchus that a person receives is not 40. It's 39. Arba'im chaser achas, 39. And that is stated by the Mishnah in Maseches Makos. towards the end of the Masechta in Daf Kaf Beis Amud Aleph, Kama Malkinoso. How many Malkus does he get? Arboim Chasar Achas. 40 less 1. 39. What's the source for this? Shene Emar, and quotes are Psukim B'mispar Arbaim. Now here we have to watch very carefully. If you look at the word Arbaim at the beginning of Pasuk Gimel, and you will see that the word before it is B'mispar, which we're not quite sure what to make of that word, and the Mishnah puts them together. Mispar Arbaim, the number of 40, which the Mishnah expounds to mean Minyan Shehu Samuch La'Arbaim, the number that precedes or leads to 40. Somehow, these two words, B'mispar Arba'im, from 40 to 39. The word mispar has the effect of deducting one from 40 to make it 39. That's a bit of an enigma for us. How does B'mispar Arba'im get you from what seems to be saying the number 40 to be the number leading to 40, which is 39? The Gemara adds some words of nation. And two lines. The Gemara states, Ma taima, why are we doing this? How are we explaining the Pasuk this way? Ikativ, had the Pasuk said, Arba'im B'mispar, reversing the order, Arba'im B'mispar, 40 in number, then Hava Amina Arba'im B'minyana, I would say 40. 40 is the number. That's had it said Arba'im B'mispar. But it doesn't say that. Hashta Dichtiv, but now that it says B'mispar Arba'im, it says, in the order that it does, first B'mispar and then Arba'im, Minyan Shuhu Sokemes Arba'im, the number that leads you to the total of 40, 39. I have to admit, I'm not any more enlightened after the Gemara's explanation than I was beforehand. We're left seemingly with a problem. B'mispar Arba'im sounds like the number 40. And yet, the Gemara is telling us that because the word B'mispar comes before Arba'im and not the other way around, it actually means 39. All of this is very mysterious. And we should note something else as well. It's something that perhaps we may not note if we were just learning the Mishnah, but we began in the Psukim. And we have to note that these two words, B'mispar and Arba'im, are not even in the same Pasuk to begin to be running them together. The word B'mispar is the final word of Pasuk Beis. The word Arba'im is the first word of Pasuk Gimel. I mean, they are separated by two very large dots because they're two separate psukim. How then could we put them together at all? So, Kol Zeh Omer Darsheni. Interestingly, the Gemara continues. A famous statement of Rava. Omar Rava, Kama Tipshoi Shar Inchi. How foolish are people? How so? Dekai Mimikni Sefer Torah. Because you can find people, if a Sefer Torah comes into the room, everybody stands up. Velo kaimi mikri gavar rabba, but they won't stand up in front of a great man, meaning a great Talmud Chacham. Now, why should they? How should one lead to the other? Why is that foolish? Because, says Rava, consider, what does the Torah look like before the great men have spoken, and what does it look like afterwards? The ilu b'sefer Torah k'tiv arba'im. I mean, that's black and white. If you look in the Torah, it says Arba'im, the Osir Rabbanon, along came the Rabbanon, Batzrichada, they deleted one of the Malkios, they deducted one of the Malkios. That takes some doing. And if they can do that, and they can, so then it's foolish to stand up for the book, but not to stand up for those that are entrusted with interpreting the book. That's Rava's statement. Now, I'd like to just summarize before we move on. Essentially what we've seen is the Mishnah and the Gemara are looking at the words B'mispar Arba'im, darshaning them to take what seems to be saying 40 and reducing it to 39. It's a drasha, as we have many drashas. Bein Einechem is darshaned as on top of the head, not between your eyes, Al Yadcha is on the bicep and not on the hand, and Mispar Arbarim is 39 and not 40. It's one of those drushes. However, when we consult the words of the Rambam in the Mishnah Torah, in Hilchas Sanhedrin, Perek Yud Zayin, Halacha Aleph, we will see something quite unexpected. Says the Rambam, Ketzad Malkin is Hamachuyav Malkos. How do we administer Malkos? How many does he get? Well, Kefi Kocho, as many as he can take. Shene Emar, Kidei Rishato, Bemispar, in keeping with his wickedness, Bemispar. The word Bemispar means the number that's appropriate, whatever he can take. Except whatever happened to 40. Vezeshene Emar Arbaim, when the Pasuk says 40, it means to say She'en Mosifen Al Arbaim, maximum of 40. As they say in modern Hebrew, Gag. 40, no more than 40. Even if he's as strong as Shimshon and he could take a good few dozen, nonetheless, never more than 40. Abal pochas in the chalash, it will never be more than 40, but it could go down. It could be that he can only take 10 or less. That's how much it is. She'im yakel chalash makaraba bevadai humesh. You don't want to give too many. You don't want to endanger his life. He's not chayav misa. You've got to err on the side of caution. And now, says Rambam, and these words should be very carefully noted by us, Lefi chachomru chachomim. Therefore, the chachomim said, Shafilu habari biyoter, even someone who is most healthy and strong, makino so shloshim v'teisha. It's got to be 39, never 40. Why? Sheim Yosef lo achas, because if you add on another, nimse shilohiko ela arbaim haru'uyoslo, because that... it's a safety measure. Even if the worst comes to worst and you added one by accident, you still gave him 40, which is really, 40 is okay. That's what the Torah says. So it's almost like a gezeira. It's a preventative decree. In other words, never more than 40. In order to ensure that he's never given more than 40, it is institutionalized that actually the number is set at maximum at 39. So worst comes to worst and you make a mistake. You gave him really what he should get anyway, which is 40. These words of the Rambam are stunning because it's very clear that the Rambam is presenting the idea of reducing from 40 to 39 not as a drosha. According to the Rambam, it's not that expound the Pasuk and the Pasuk is saying 39. The Pasuk is not saying 39. The Pasuk says 40. The rabbi said 39. Why? So you shouldn't come to 40. It's left as a buffer. That means the reduction from 40 to 39 is not a drasha, it's a protective measure of the rabbis. It's like not blowing shofar when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos. You shouldn't come to carry. Don't give him 40, so you shouldn't come to give him more than 40. Give him 39. Worst comes to worst, he'll get 40, which is okay anyway. How can the Rambam say this? If you look at the Mishnah, if you look at the Gemara did not present it as a protective measure. The Gemara presents it as a drasha, seemingly as a din d'oraisa that it's 39. Well, says Rabbi Yosef Karo, in the Kesef Mishnah, the source of the Rambam presents a protective measure by the rabbis are Rava's words. Rava about standing up for a Sefer Torah and for a Gavra Rabba. Because Rava's words were, the Torah says 40, Asu Rabbanon, the rabbis came and they took one off. And the Rambam looks at those words and understands those words at face value. That what the rabbis did is not that they interpreted the Pasuk in a way that it really means 39. They took one off. The Pasuk means 40. And they said 39. That's Gavra Rabba. But that sounds like it's an institution of the rabbis. What about the exposition of the Pasuk, B'mispar Abayim, Abayim B'mispar, really sounds like says the Kesef Mishnah, that drasha is known in the category of what's known as an asmachta. An asmachta is a rabbinic law that is based on or attached to the Pasuk. It's presented as a drasha, but it's not a drasha on a Torah level, rather it's midrabanan. Okay, so if according to the Rambam, I would say the pressure's off to understand the drasha, to understand how the words b'mispar boim work, because they actually don't mean that. It's a, the rabbis presented it as a drasha. And yet, we can't help but notice that the Gemara seems to have gone out of its way to explain this drasha. I think that's noteworthy. As if to say, we find once in a while that the rabbis present something as a drasha, and it's not actually a drasha. Netilas Yadayim is midrabanan, but it's based on an asmachta. But we don't go to town to say, had the pasuk said like this, had the pasuk said like this. That type of establishing the infrastructure sounds like the sort of thing that you do for an actual Torah drasha. If it's an asmachta, one doesn't need to put oneself out so much, but the Gemara really is discussing it in such a thorough way. Why is that so? Moreover, we should note something else, which is very interesting. If indeed the reduction from 40 to 39 is rabbinic, it should be disallowed for the following reason. Now, we know the rabbis make protective measures the whole time. However, there is one basic proviso, and that is, it's possible for the rabbis, shall we say, to suspend Din Torah on occasion. But what's not acceptable is for the rabbis to systematically and completely say something which is at odds with what the Torah said. Because that is, it puts them in absolute opposition 100% with what the Torah is saying. That's not acceptable. I'll illustrate what I mean with the case that's coming up quite soon. And this is the famous principle of the Taz. We know that, which you mentioned just a moment ago, when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, so we don't blow shofar. That is your classic rabbinic protective measure. The Torah says, blow shofar. The rabbi said, don't blow shofar to protect against Din Torah itself. Shema Yavirenu, that you shouldn't come to carry. So one of the Rishonim, Rabbi Nissim, asked a very interesting question. When Rosh Hashanah doesn't fall on Shabbos, if it falls during the week, it's still Yom Tov. Making sounds with instruments is forbidden on Yom Tov as well. That you shouldn't come to perhaps Shema Yitakin Klishir, you shouldn't come to repair the instrument if it breaks, develops a problem. You could potentially violate a Torah law when on whatever day of the week Rosh Hashanah falls, because it's always Yom Tov. And there's always that worry, Shem Yitak and Klishir, that's why you don't play the piano on the Shabbos or Yom Tov and all of those other protective measures. So it's a very disturbing question, because see what the Ran is asking is, pardon me, it's the Rabbi Eliyahu Mizrahi is asking, is that if the worry of a Torah prohibition always exists, then blowing the shofar should not only be suspended when Rosh Hashanah falls on Shabbos, it should be suspended when Rosh Hashanah falls on Yom Tov, which is always. So you should never blow the shofar. Why did you distinguish between the different concerns? And to this question, the Taz responds, that is exactly the reason why it cannot happen. Because you can never have a situation where the Torah says blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah, and the rabbi says never blow the shofar on Rosh Hashanah. That's an unacceptable situation. That puts them absolutely, pits them against the words of the Torah. And therefore, for it to be 0% as opposed to 100%, that's not acceptable. The only possible situation is that the rabbis say, generally when Rosh Hashanah falls during the week, you will blow the shofar. It's only in a certain instance or circumstance when it falls on Shabbos, then you don't blow the shofar. That does not have the problematic situation of placing the Rabbanan at loggerheads completely or categorically and totally with the words of the Torah. And what we see from this principle of the Taz is that it's only possible for the rabbis to, shall we say, partially or situationally detract from what the Torah is saying for protective reasons. But to consistently and always detract, that's not acceptable. And if that's the case, then let's come back to our situation of 40 Malkus versus 39. According to the Rambam, the Torah says 40. And when it says 40, it means 40. It doesn't mean 39. It means 40. But the rabbi said, well, you know, if you're 40, it may come to 41. That's a problematic situation. And therefore, we will always have 40 less 1. You will never actually get the amount that the Torah said. Never is a problem. Because even for protective reasons, the rabbis can't leave you in a situation where you never fulfilled Din Torah. That is the question of the Minchas Chinuch. And what I would like to do by way of perhaps understanding the Rambam's position is as follows. If a person can't take that many malchus, he can take a few but not the whole lot. So he only gets a few. Where does that come from? How do we know that? What's the source? Well, the Rambam tells us the source. If you can only take a few, he only gets a few, as it says, b'mispar. The final word of Pasuk Beis, k'dei rishaso, b'mispar. B'mispar means he gets the number that he can take. That's what the word means. Now, if that's true, then we actually have two answers coming from the Torah. How many malchus does he get? It depends which pasuk you look at. If you look at the end of Pasuk Beis, the answer is whatever he can take. If you look at the beginning of Pasuk Gimel, the answer is 40. Well, if that's true, I think it's fair to say that these two rulings are written in the opposite order that we would have expected. In other words, if you know the halacha, you'll know that how many does he get? In principle, he gets however many it is. And if he can't take that number, so then in a contingency situation, he'll get less. In other words, the idea of only getting what he can take, that's almost like the bidyeved answer. That's if, you, in principle, it's a certain amount. In practice, it may be less. Which means that the correct way to present these amounts is the Torah should have said, he gets however many it is, 40, and if necessary, less. You don't start with if necessary, that seems to be counterintuitive. And yet the Torah, so to speak, has reversed the order. It's almost put the bidyeved in first. How many does he get? Well, he might not be able to take the whole lot. You can't start that way. But the Torah does. Apparently, the answer in principle to the question of how many does he get is b'mispar, however many he can take. That is the answer. If you would only say one thing, that's what you would say, whatever he can take. But that sounds very different than the number 40. What then does the Torah mean by giving a number if we've already answered the question? Well, Rambam himself explains that if you've already said he gets what he can take, and then you give the number 40, it means the Torah isn't saying he gets 40. The Torah is saying no more than 40. That, it's such a delicate parshanut point, but that is the difference between saying arba'im b'mispar or b'mispar arba'im. If you say arba'im b'mispar, then 40 is the answer. And b'mispar is the contingency situation. But 40 means 40. Whereas, if you say, as the Torah does say, b'mispar arba'im, then everything changes. The answer is what he can take, and 40 is not the answer. 40 means no more than 40. And so, what difference does it make for us? Well, the difference is, could the rabbis come and consistently deduct one of his malchus? Could they say it will always be 39, no more, never 40, ever? Can they say that as a protective measure? Well, that depends on the order of the words. Had the Torah said, Arba'im b'mispar, Arba'im is the number 40, is the amount, so then you can't ever be in a situation where you'll never get 40, because that puts you in opposition with what the Torah said. The Torah says 40, and you say never. But since the Torah said b'mispar arba'im, if we're following the delicacy here, once it says b'mispar arba'im, so 40 means no more than 40. How do you satisfy the requirement of no more than 40? By having no more than 40. 39 is also no more than 40. It's not 40, but it's no more than 40. That means that the din Torah of Arba'im, meaning no more than 40, is satisfied however many you give him, as long as it's no more than 40. And if it's always 39, or maximum 39, so be it. 39 is also no more than 40. And therefore, we understand why the Gemara went to such lengths to discuss the order of these two words, b'mispar Arba'im versus Arba'im b'mispar. Because it's critical, even though it's not a d'oraisa drasha, it's a drabanan protective measure, but it's critical to establish the order of the words, because it's that order that allows the rabbanan to bring in their measure. As if to say, when we say that the Torah said b'mispar Arba'im, and therefore it's 39, we're not saying the Torah says 39. We're saying that allows us to say 39, because putting the word b'mispar first means that the word 40 is no more than 40, and 39 is also no more than 40. And if this is the case, we are no longer bothered by the fact that the words b'mispar and arba'im feature in two separate psukim, which they do. B'mispar is the end of pasuk beis, and arba'im is the beginning of gimel. And our question was, how can you take a phrase, how can you take these two words in two separate psukim and run them together as one phrase? According to the Rambam, that's not what's happening at all. Rather, they remain where they are, because they're two separate messages. B'mispar means however many you can take. Arba'im is a new message, no more than 40. But nonetheless, that gives you the basis for saying 39 consistently, that it shouldn't be ever more than 40. So this understanding of through the Rambam essentially has resolved all of the questions with regards to these two very interesting psukim. After that light discussion, I feel it's apropos to mention a maisa which occurred, which I heard from my father Zatzal. An exchange that took place between two of the greats of pre-war Europe, Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, Zatzal, and the Ostrovtzer Rebbe, Reb Meir Yechiel of Ostrovtzer. And they were, as the story has it, vacationing in the same place, and of course when Gedolim are on vacation, that means they have a chance to talk Torah with each other uninterrupted. And so Reb Chaim Moshe said to the Ostrovtzer Rebbe, he says, you know, please tell me a Dvar Torah, Zogepes. So the Rebbe says, well, you're Reb Chaim Moshe Grudzinski, what am I going to tell you that you don't know? But Reb Chaim Moshe says, nonetheless. So the Ostrovtzer Rebbe, who himself was a massive Talmud Chacham, he told Reb Chaim Moshe over a Shtikl Torah, and Reb Chaim Moshe was very taken by it. And he said to the Ostrovtzer Rebbe, I see from this Dvar Torah that you're a Gavur Rabba, you're a great person. And to that, the Ostrovtzer Rebbe says, I can't accept that compliment. Because saying over a good Shtikl Torah doesn't make you a Gavur Rabba. It can make you a Talmud Chacham. It doesn't make you a great person, not a Gavur Rabba. So Reb Chaim Moshe was quite perplexed by this, because what is a Gavur Rabba if not a Talmud Chacham? I mean, the Gemara refers to Gavur Rabbas. So the Ostrovtzer Rebbe says, my source for what I said is in the Gemara. You see, the Gemara which we just quoted, Rava, who talks about people who are foolish, they'll stand up when a Sefer Torah comes in. They don't stand up when a Gavur Rabba comes in. And who are the Gavur Rabbas? The Rabbanon. Why? Because the Torah said 40, and the Rabbanon came and took one away. So the Ostrovtzer Rebbe asks a simple question. Is this the first drasha that we ever find in the Torah whereby the Torah seems to be saying one thing and then the Rabbanon explain things differently? I mean, you've got Shemos, you've got Bnei Nechem and Al Yodcha and Mimachras HaShabbos, is it Sunday, is it the second day of Pesach? You've got plenty of examples long before this situation of Malkus where the rabbis said something quite different than what the simple reading of the words seems to say. And Rava never pointed to those cases to say, oh, that's a Gavur Rabba. He pointed to this case. And the reason why, says the Ostrovtzer Rebbe, is because in this case something else happened. Not only did they radically give us a different understanding of the halacha, but someone who was about to get 40 malchus now only gets 39. To prevent someone from Yisrael from receiving one extra lash, or to diminish or lessen his distress or discomfort, if you put yourself out for that, that's what makes you a gavra rabba. And that's why this example was chosen. Definition of a gavra rabba is not someone who says a drosha. Gavra rabba specifically is someone who extends themselves to lessen the suffering or discomfort of another Jew. That's how Reb Meir Chiel explained to Reb Chaim Ozer. And I'd like to mention, apropos of this, another very similar idea which I came across recently in a biography that was published about Rav Kreisworth Zatzal, the great Rav of Antwerp, firstly earlier than that in Chicago, and he was of course a towering Talmud Chacham, and he also had occasion to comment on the concept of Gavra Rabba, a great person. And this was actually when one of the great poskim of Eretz Yisrael, Rav Nosson Gestetner, the author of the Shelas HaTshuvas Lahoros Nosson, world-class posek, visited Antwerp, and there was a Kabbalas Panim. And Rav Kreisworth spoke in his honor and referred to a Gemara in Maseches Brachos and Daf Lamed Ches. And there the Gemara said that there was a certain individual, Rav Zvid was his name, and he was introduced, or Rav Zeira was told about, that he was a Gavra Rabba. So Rav Zeira was quite intrigued, and he says, if he ever comes to town, bring him to me, Gavra Rabba, I'd like to meet him. Sure enough, in the fullness of time, Rav Zvid is passing through, and they brought him to Rav Zeira. So they sat down, they had a suda, and Rav Zeira gave Rav Zvid to break bread, and Rav Zvid made the bracha, and the bracha he made was motzi lechem min ha'aretz. Not ha-motzi, but motzi lechem min ha'aretz. Interesting. Now, a bit of background, actually. The halacha is that if you say motzi lechem min ha'aretz, not ha-motzi, you're yotze. Actually, according to everyone, you're yotze. If you say ha-motzi, is that also okay? It's a machlokas, and we pass them that you are yotze. Of course, we all say hamotzi. And therefore, Rabbi Zeira was actually quite disappointed by Rav Zvid, because he seems to have taken the easy way out. He chose the nusach of the bracha that everyone agrees with, so he didn't really show much. He said, you call that a gavra rabba? He should have said hamotzi, because in saying hamotzi, then he would have shown that although there's a machlokas, we paskin like those who say that hamotzi is also acceptable. You would have gotten more Torah value for your bracha. So he was a bit disappointed in Rav Zvid. But the Gemara explains the reason why Rav Zvid said motzi, because he didn't want to get involved in a machlokas. They say motzi is good for everyone. So what's fascinating is, if you look at the Gemara, it sounds like he was pitted as a gavra rabba. In the event, he didn't really show himself as a gavra rabba, which is a bit of a disappointment, but in his defense, he didn't want to get involved in a machlokas. It says Rav Kreisworth, those concluding words, he didn't want to get himself involved in machlokas, they're not the Gemara defending him. That's the Gemara explaining why he's called a gavra rabba. Because someone who takes steps to avoid a machlokas, that's what makes him a gavra rabba. He's a prominent personality. It's very easy for people like that to get swept up in machlokas. And therefore, on the contrary, the Gemara here is saying, no, it was correct to call him a gavra rabba. Look what happened. When, in any given situation, he took the path that would place him as far away as possible from machlokas. And again, it's quite similar. It resonates really with what the Ostrotzer Rebbe was saying, is that it's not only prowess in Torah that makes a person a gavra rabba, but moreover, they're looking either in the Ostrotzer Rebbe's circumstance to lessen the suffering of another Jew, or equally valuable to avoid machlokas. If you can be in a prominent position and avoid machlokas, as Kreisworth, and that's a community rav talking, you are a gavra rabba and fully deserving of that title. So that's with regards to gavra rabbas. There is just one final comment, which is comes from the Maharal in his Peirush Gur Aryeh about the 49 and 30. We can't escape the fact that even if it's a full drasha, it really looks like it's 40. I mean, Arba'im really sounds a lot like 40. And something happened, but Mispar Arba'im. And the Maharal says what that means is that it really should be 40, and the Torah deducts one. It says Arba'im because it should be 40. Why? So the Maharal, in his own unique way, explains that the reason why there are 40 malchus is because the person needs to be punished, and the person has 40 parts to him. Why does he have 40 parts to him? It corresponds to the what Chazal referred to as the 40 days of the critical days, formational days of the Vlad, of the embryo, our Arba'im Yom of Yetziras HaVlad. And therefore, corresponding to those 40 days of formation, each one deserves a lash, because he's taken a wrong turn. However, says Maharal, there's more to it than that. Because on day 40, that's the day when the neshama comes in to the child. And the truth of the matter is, the neshama doesn't really deserve a lash. It's just the first 39 days of developing the child physically. By the time the day 40, the neshama comes in, it shares the being with 39 parts of physicality. That's bound to draw the whole person to sin, or liable to do so. And if he does, so you look for the culprit. You look for the culprit within the person. It's not the entire person. But rather, in principle, 40. In practice, if you give him 39, part number 40 should be fine to go on its way. Lahavdil, it's almost like sometimes there's a group of children who are making mischief or misbehaving or causing mayhem. And it's understood that some of them are the culprits and one of them is a good kid. He fell into bad company. He'll be treated differently, because if you address the problem with the other kids, he'll be fine by himself. He would never do this by himself. So the Maharal is saying that really when the Torah says it's 40 and not 40, because in principle it's the whole person, but really the neshama fell into bad company called the body. And it's a problem. But if you deal with the body, then the neshama just needs a bit of a schmooze, a bit of a talking to, and it's fine. It just needs to take a bit of a moral instruction from the 39 that the body got, and it will be fine. And it's such a fascinating, not only in terms of the parshanut, but it's such an important statement as well, because really that means that whenever the Torah punishes a person, it's also validating the person, as if to say, whenever because to condemn the person or to write him off is the worst. That every punishment is ultimately for some form of rectification, and there's from a certain point of view a great deal of encouragement. The Torah says you are not a lost case. You took a wrong turn. You did a wrong deed. You have to answer for it. But we'll never punish you, the actual you, the person. The body will take a bit of a musr, and you'll be good to go. So it's actually it's an encouraging message that the person leaves, and that's why the pasuk ends with the words v'nikla achicha le'inecha. He needs to be punished, but he's your brother. He's still in play. He's still part in within the fold, and should be treated that way and encouraged as such. So these are some remarks with regards to arbaim yarkenu b'mispar arbaim. And let us move from there to the section at the end of the parsha, and that is Zohar. And what's interesting about Zohar, that is to say Zohar of Amalek, is that we are used to relating to it or discussing it as a self-contained entity. It's the reading for Parsha Zohar. That's what it's famous as. But it's also the end of Parshas Kisetse, and specifically from within the context of Kisetse, there are aspects of the Parsha that we can glean that we wouldn't get by taking it by itself. Because we get to take a look at what preceded it and perhaps whether those are connected. And indeed, we will see that they are. When it says Zachor, which is the final three psukim of the Parsha, Perek Kafei Pasuk Yud Zayin, well, the section that came before is about faulty or dishonest weights and measures, as it says in Pasuk Yud Gimel. Lo yeh lecha b'kischa even v'oven, gedolo ketano. You shouldn't have different types of weights depending, are you buying, are you selling, etc. But rather, that's all got to be in order. There could be no dishonesty in terms of these weights and measures, which is basically dishonesty in business. And then the next topic is Amalek. How does one lead to the other? What's one got to do with the other? And Rashi comments in Pasuk Yud Zayin on the word Zachor, Eis Asher Salacha, what we call Smichas Parshios, the juxtaposition of these two ideas. Im Shikarta, Bemidus of Mashkolos, if you've been dishonest in Weights and Measures, Heve Doeg, you should be worried, Megira Ha'oyev, from the enemy. And who is the enemy? Molik. It's quite a striking statement of Rashi, and again it's from Chazal, as if to say that there are certain things that can precipitate or can empower a Molik, can lead one to be concerned that a Molik will be a force. And among them, dishonesty in business practices, it's quite an unlikely association that we would have made. How is it that we darshan the Smichus Parshios, that we make this observation in terms of the two sections? Rabbeinu Bachya has a fascinating comment, and it's classic parshanut. You see, says Rabbeinu Bachya, if you look at Pasuk Yud Gimel, it's a prohibition not to have different types of weights, and Pasuk Yud Dalet, another prohibition not to have different types of measures. So Pasuk Yud Gimel and Yud Dalet are what you shouldn't do. Then Pasuk Tes Vav, what you should have. Even Shleim of Atzedek Yelach, they should all be uniform, correct, and honest. Eifa Shleim of Atzedek Yelach, Leman Yericho Yomecha, Alo Adama, Asher Hashem Lokecha, No Seinach, you should have a Richos Yomim, and it's all good. And then the final Pasuk of that small section goes back to the bad. Pasuk Tet Zayin, Ki Tov As Hashem Elokecha Kolo Se'ele, for that's an abomination. Anyone who, in Hashem's eyes, anyone who does these things, Kolo Se'ovel, anyone who perverts justice or business. So Rabbeinu Bachya says, it's very interesting. If we just summarize the flow of that small parsha, you have two psukim, what not to do, and then the third pasuk, what you should do, and if you do everything will be fine, and then the fourth pasuk goes back to say how bad the first things were. But that's not the intuitive order. Rather, it should have said, firstly, Pasuk Yud Gimel Yud Dalet, don't have those faulty weights. Why? Because they're Tov As Hashem. And then move from there to what you should have, because that will lead to all good things. So the Torah seems to have deferred the verdict or evaluation of that Ki Tov As Hashem Elokecha Kol Osei Eile. It seems to have delayed it and put it at the end of that section, unnaturally, so to speak, in order to lead into Amalek. That's why Rashi notes the Smichus Parshios here, because the Torah has actually given a different shape to this parsha to ensure that the discussion of To'eva comes back just before it moves into Amalek to tell you that those two things are connected. And how are they connected? How is Even Va'oven, faulty weights and measures, what's it got to do with Amalek? Well, Mefarshim explain on a very straightforward level that a person who cheats in business, has faulty weights and measures, is someone who has no notion that his parnasa is directed from above, because he's prepared to do whatever it takes, even dishonest means, in order to get his money. That means he has no notion that actually someone is taking care of his money. He just needs to act appropriately, to act correctly. In other words, someone who institutionalizes into his business practices these faulty weights and measures is someone, he's basically saying, in the more nefarious sense of the word, emein ani li mili, if it's not me, no one's going to look out for me, meaning even Hashem is not going to look out for me. I've got to look out for number one, whatever it is. The Torah says not to do it. This takes precedence, because otherwise how else am I going to get my money? That's someone who has basically subscribed to the thesis of Amalek, for what Amalek stands for and what Amalek represents, and what Amalek goes to war over is the disconnect of any divine supervision from on high to anything that happens in the lower realms. Asher karcha baderech, as we know, karcha is an expression of mikra. There's nothing as guide, nothing as directed. They don't want things to be directed, because then a person needs to answer for his actions. Rather, the two are distinct. And in fact, the famous statement of the end of Parshas Beshalach, when we had our first war with Amalek, ki yod al kes ka. A kes ka, the name ka, is really yud ke vav ke, but it's cut in half, it's truncated. As Rashi says, ein ha-shem shalem, ein ha-kiseh shalem, that Hashem's name will not be complete until Amalek is eradicated. Hashem's name represents people's appreciation of how he relates to the world. And as the Mefarshim point out, the letters Yud and Hey, those first two letters, they represent, in the most general of sense, the divine emanation on the higher realms. The Vav and the Hey as the, are a progression of divine emanation to the lower realms. Amalek, it is of the essence for them to break the connection between those two. They have no problem with the letters Yud and Hey, because as long as God is up there and we're down here, and there the twain shall meet, where everything will be fine. Their problem is with the Vav and the Hey, that there should be supervision, direction, and therefore accountability. That's something that they will looking to avoid at all costs and even go to war against. Which means, of course, someone wouldn't see himself like that. But the faulty weights and measures are subscribing on some nominal level to the ethos of Amalek. Emeina nili mili, no one else is going to look out for me. And indeed, the very first war with Amalek was precipitated by the Jewish people enunciating just such a question, just such a concern. They came in the desert, and they asked in Rephidim, "Hayesh Hashem bekirbeinu imayin? Is Hashem with us? Is He not with us?" And meaning with us wherever we are. And the very next words of the Torah are "Vayavo Amalek." That question can empower Amalek, because don't have their convictions, and if they're not connected to the idea that Yesh Hashem bekirbeinu, so that empowers Amalek. And this is a fascinating idea, because it turns out that the strength or the weakness, the strengthening or the weakening of Amalek is significantly a function of the beliefs of Bnei Yisrael. And it's possible for Bnei Yisrael to strengthen him, and it's possible for Bnei Yisrael to weaken him. And Amalek as an attitude is still very much prevalent, and according to many Mefarshim, we refer to it on the Tfilis, on the Yomim Noraim, where we say, Ki tavir memsheles adom min ha'aretz, memsheles adom, the reign of willfulness. That is a reference to many, to Amalek, because what we stand for on Rosh Hashanah, and by extension throughout the year, but significantly on Rosh Hashanah, is that to recognize Hashem as King over the world, and that recognition itself can lead to Ki tavir memsheles adom. Hashem says He will eradicate the Zecher Amalek, but He's given us to do so also. And the fascinating idea that comes out is that part of the war against Amalek does not just take place on the physical plane in terms of identifying them and killing them, which has its own discussion, but part of the war with Amalek is to refuse to empower them. The war takes place with each and every Jew, as he says, Yesh Hashem bekirbeinu, that itself can lead to the demise of Amalek, Ki savim memsheles adom min ha'aretz, which we daven for in Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur, and that's something that as we strengthen ourselves in should be something fulfilled. Be'meheru b'yameinu.